Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Many state and local governments are struggling with how to pay for employee retirement plans. Republican lawmakers have introduced legislation that would require greater transparency of public pension funds. It would also ban the federal government from rescuing troubled funds. Some opponents see the measure in the House and Senate as an attack on public employees. Joining me here in the studio to talk about the health of the nation's public pensions, Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
Sarah Murray of the Wall Street Journal. Sarah, it's good to have you here.
It's great to be here.
Joining us by phone from Capitol Hill is Andrew Biggs of the American Enterprise Institute. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane.
And before we begin our conversation among those three guests, we're joined by phone from California, Congressman Devin Nunes. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And tell me what you hope to accomplish with the Public Employee Pension Transparency Act.
Essentially, what we're trying to do is cut off or try to stop from happening what you see happening in Wisconsin, Ohio, Indiana to some degree, and potential state bankruptcies in Illinois and California. You're seeing what Governor Christie in New Jersey is having to do. Basically, we're at this point in time now in history because we do not know what we owe to the public employees through their pension programs. So the unfunded liabilities, you have guests on your show today that know a lot more about it than I do, but they're somewhere between $1 trillion to possibly as high as $5 trillion, which is basically insurmountable for the states to come up with that kind of money to pay employees into the retirement. So the bill that we have proposed essentially deals with that crisis that's about ready to happen.
Tell me why you think the U.S. Congress should get involved at all.
Well, essentially, you just saw in Illinois, Governor Quinn's budget alluded to potential federal bailout. To some degree, President Obama's stimulus plan from a couple years ago was essentially a federal bailout to public employee unions in many respects. And so what you see happening is that you have two things happening. One is that the states have come and will continue to come to the federal government for a bailout, which the federal government is in need of its own bailout, that it has no one to bail it out. And secondly, and probably more importantly to some degree, is you have the muni bond market, which relies on selling tax-exempt bonds to fund many state and local projects, are actually subsidized by the federal taxpayer. So without action quickly, and really remember, this is not any type of bill that does anything but try to help the public employees, because we're just trying to get the public employees' information to know what exactly they have in their retirement account and can they count on it or not. And also, this would protect the taxpayer.
Is this, in your mind, Congressman Nunes, is it a political or a financial fight?
In Washington or at the state level or both?
Both.
Look, this is a financial disaster that we have on our hands, and I'm not saying that it's only because of public employee pensions. But what it is caused by is a tendency in kind of socialist utopian style governments, which we've slowly become in some states like California, and at the federal level, I believe when we're spending $3.7 trillion and taking in $2.5 trillion, we have a spending problem. And Margaret Thatcher, I think, famously said, I think this was her original words. I don't know if she stole it from someone else or not, but I'll steal it from her and say that socialist governments work great until you run out of other people's money. And we are at that point. In fact, we are at that point so much that I would actually go to say that it's becoming a national security threat. So failure to deal with a whole host of problems, one of them being public employee pensions, could lead to financial ruin for this country and many states.
How might your bill affect the rights of unions to bargain collectively?
This bill wouldn't have anything to do with that. Essentially, all the Public Employee Pension Transparency Act does is exactly what it's titled. So it would essentially have a web portal for all Americans to be able to go to, where the public pensions would put up their numbers. So essentially, what are their assets, what are their liabilities, and what is their expected outcome on how they're going to meet their financial obligations. That's the first thing it does. The second thing it does is it then takes those numbers that the pension plans put up online, and it runs them to a conservative discount rate. So then all over the country, you can compare the roughly 2,500 public employee pensions against each other to know which plan is better funded compared to other plans. And that's essentially what the bill does, and then, of course, says that the federal government's not going to come in and bail these pensions out. It does three things. Those are the three. It's pretty cut and dried. And I think had we had a bill like this in place, we wouldn't be seeing what we're seeing in Wisconsin and some other states, because public policymakers and the employees themselves would have been well aware of this problem, and it wouldn't just been dropped on them like it is here in the recent months.
Congressman Devin Nunes, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate it.
All right. And turning to you, Ross Eisenbray, how do you respond to the congressman's points about somehow the government reaching for some socialist utopian form of government?
It's stunning for him to say that. I don't agree with really anything that he said about either the causes of the state's problems or the value of his solution. The cause of the state's problems is not that their pensions are too generous or that, as he said, public employees don't know and the state taxpayers don't know how much is owed for them. The problem is that we had a tremendous financial collapse, the worst since the Great Depression. It wrecked state revenues. State revenues are still down more than 12% from where they were before the disaster. And, the real solution to a problem like that is to deal with the Wall Street, to deal with, the corrupt practices of mortgage brokers who were peddling toxic securities, subprime mortgages, and turning them into toxic securities with the help of Lehman Brothers and other Wall Street firms, Goldman Sachs, and then selling them to pension plans as AAA-rated securities when, in fact, they were junk. That's the real problem.
Do you agree with the congressman's estimates that the pensions could be in debt by as much as $1 to $5 trillion?
No. I think that's he called it on the basis of conservative assumptions. I would say it's just plain accounting gimmickry. That there's a way that the Government Accounting Standards Board has been requiring states to account for their liabilities. It's used all over the country. It's used everywhere, and it's common sense. It says, What is the expected growth of the assets that you have? And most states say the expected growth is about 8% because that's the historical return that they've gotten.
But that has not been the case.
No, it is the case over, if you measure it over 20 years or a 30-year span, which is, these states go on. They're not going out of business like a small business or a corporation. So the right discount rate is the one that they've been using. They've met their targets over time. And for example, last year they made 12.5%.
Ross Eisenbray, the Economic Policy Institute, Andrew Biggs, how do you see it?
Ross makes a good analogy to what happened in the housing and the financial crisis, but I would take a different lesson from it. When I first moved to Washington, 10, 12 years ago, I worked on the House Banking Committee, where we looked at issues of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and housing. And back then, even this was a long time ago, we had hearings and people were saying, look, we have problems here. They're playing fast and loose. There's a danger to it. But people would come back and say, oh, no, but they're doing good things, letting low-income people buy houses. Let's not rock the boat. And we know, $150 billion of bailouts to Fannie and Freddie later, we know we made a mistake. The thing that I think could be a real shame is that we're just recovering from our last sort of self-inflicted financial crisis, and with public sector pensions, we could move into our next one. Economists are almost unanimous in saying that the accounting rules that public sector pensions use in valuing their liabilities and determining how much to put towards to fund those liabilities are wrong. They're unanimous in this. They believe that the rules they use, which use the expected rate of return on a risky portfolio of assets to value liabilities, which are guaranteed by law, is fundamentally wrong. It encourages the plans to promise too much in terms of benefits, to fund too little on a year-to-year basis, and to take too much risk with the money they're investing. So there's just a disagreement here between how things work, but I think the economics community really says we need a change before it's too late.
Andrew Biggs, he's resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. When we come back, we'll talk further. Take your calls, your email. I look forward to hearing from you. And we're back talking with Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute, Sarah Murray of the Wall Street Journal, and Andrew Biggs of the American Enterprise Institute, all about public pensions. Turning to you, Sarah Murray, Moody's Ratings Agency supports the Pension Transparency Act. What's the significance of that?
It's significant because it says this is not purely a political issue. The fact that a ratings agency is saying, the transparency isn't really up to par, we should have more information out there, is important. And they say that it will force states to sort of look their pension obligations in the face and make some significant changes.
How do you react to that, Ross Eisenbray?
Well, I think transparency is great. I don't think that the federal government should be telling Maryland and, places that are better managed than the federal government has been, how to manage their pension plans. But transparency is good if you use a good measure. If you're using a sort of crackpot measure that would require you to overfund plans or that scares people into thinking that the liabilities are four times bigger than they are, you're causing actually more problems than you're solving.
Andrew Biggs, if you would, how would the Public Employee Pension Act change the way that states value their pension funds?
Well, it would not require the states themselves change how they value or fund their liabilities. It would simply require them to report a measure that most economists think is appropriate. The way it works now is if you have a benefit liability paid sometime in the future, the plans discount it back to the present at the rate of return they expect on their investments, the 8% return. And economists think that's wrong because those liabilities are guaranteed. They're guaranteed usually by law, by state constitutions. And so the way economic logic works is you should discount the liability to the present using an interest rate that is commensurate with the risk of the liability. If the interest rate or if the liability is guaranteed, you should use a low interest rate like what you would get on U.S. Treasury bonds. So the Nunes bill would essentially require that plans report their liabilities valued on a risk-adjusted basis, valued on the U.S. Treasury return. And
so
that obviously would be a bigger number.
How do public pensions operate differently then from private pensions?
This is an interesting point because private sector pensions are required to value their liabilities using an interest rate derived from a portfolio of high-quality corporate bonds. And the logic of this is that private defined benefit pensions are very safe, but they're not riskless. If the company goes under, part of your benefits can be lost. So they use an interest rate which reflects a moderate amount of risk. Public sector pension benefits are effectively 100% guaranteed. So they should use a lower interest rate than the corporate bond rate that private sector pensions do. Instead, they use a higher interest rate. So the short story is if public sector pensions were required to use the accounting standards that private sector pensions use, instead of reporting $500 billion in unfunded liabilities, you'd be looking at somewhere around $3 trillion.
Ross.
Well, it's inappropriate for them to do that. Corporations go out of business, and the federal government is required to step in with a termination insurance program to pay off the pensions that are underfunded. So the government requires them to use a different interest rate, a different discount rate. These state governments are going to go on forever. They've been there for hundreds of years, and they'll be there for hundreds of years more. So the discount rate that Andrew is proposing and Nunes is proposing is wrong. The plans aren't investing treasury bonds. They're investing in a mixed portfolio that gets a return of 8 or 9%, and they're actually using a conservative assumption. They generally actually get a higher return than their assumption.
Sarah, do you want to comment?
I think there's certainly a valid argument that the rate of return on investment in the bill is a little bit too conservative. You're looking at about a 4% rate of return, so about half of what it assumes now. For a large share of corporations, which like Ross said, can declare bankruptcy, can go out of business, their return on investment is about 6%. So this would be an even more conservative rate than for a lot of corporations who could potentially go under.
Here is a powerful comment posted on our website from Robert, who says, pardon me, as a retired high school teacher, I'm amazed how Wall Street, a war in Iraq, bank scandals, and many other illustrations of wrongdoing received no punishment, while people who've worked hard their entire careers are now threatened by the very governments we serve. He says, I coached softball for 15 years, the debate team, the mock trial team, women's and men's basketball, many more activities over my 29 years. If you add up the hours I worked, it was below minimum wage. I didn't complain because I knew the big picture. Pension, medical, made it worth the time. I sit here now receiving chemotherapy, wondering if my medical coverage will be stopped. Even worse, I'm almost happy they discovered it now while I still have insurance. The bottom line is the public workers didn't create this crisis. The politicians did. Andrew.
Well, nobody has proposed, and in fact, it would be illegal to cut benefits that have already been earned. Once you've earned a certain level of public pension benefits, in most states, those benefits are effectively guaranteed. So if you're a retiree out there and collecting benefits, they can't be cut. Retiree health benefits are an entirely different issue in terms of the legal protections and in terms of the accounting rules that are applied to them. So they're a separate issue from pensions. I would like to just return quickly to something Ross said, where he referred to this idea of market valuation as a crackpot measure. I don't like to drop names, and so I won't actually say the name, but I was discussing this the other day with a fellow who has won the Nobel Prize in economics. And he basically said to me, I don't understand why the pensions don't get this. And now, like, if you won the Nobel Prize, things come easier to you in terms of understanding things. But the point I would make to Ross is, I mean, Ross, you have plenty of good economists in your organization. I can promise you, just go talk to them, and they'll say, this is how economics works. There was a speech given a year or so ago by the number two at the Federal Reserve Board, and he said, economists are well known for disagreeing about things. On one hand, this; on the other hand, that. What they unanimously agree on is, if you're valuing a low-risk guaranteed liability, you have to use a low interest rate. And so it's unequivocally in contravention of economic theory, of private pension accounting, and of the basic functioning of financial
markets. All right. And, Sarah, in your reporting, I know you've talked to a great many economists. Is there one view that's out there that you believe is overriding all the others?
You know, like Andrew said, economists take different views all the time. And so to say that all economists are on one side of this issue is clearly not a fair representation of where economists are. I do think there are a fair number of economists who think this 8% return on investment is a little bit too high, even though historically we have been able to keep up with that. But then you get into a situation like this where a recession batters your investments and states manage their funds irresponsibly, and all of a sudden you're in the middle of a crisis. And so I think the idea is, going forward, we don't want to set ourselves up for that again.
And Ross, turning to you, is there in your mind a coordinated effort on the part of Republicans to take power from unions and reduce retirement benefits for public workers?
Well, I think there is, but there's a bigger problem, which is that there's a coordinated effort to take away retirement security from all workers. I mean, Andrew is part of a movement, Congressman Nunez is part of it, that wants to privatize Social Security. They want to privatize public pensions. I mean, they're in favor of actually doing away with public pensions and converting them into 401k plans, which are much less secure, which are for each dollar of benefit delivered are much more expensive, but which, because they're privatized, will allow people on Wall Street to make a lot of money off of them. It's the same dynamic that we've seen with Social Security, and that's the bigger issue.
Well, but there must be some kind of problem. You've got the Securities and Exchange Commission devoting an entire team to investigating public pensions. Why do you think that is?
Well, there are two things here. For one, the Government Accounting Standards Board spent 3 years looking at this and rejected the Biggs-Nunez proposal. Okay, so to say that this is unanimous is just not true. And we could go into that about what he's talking about. He's not talking about how pension plans ought to operate. But the real problem with the pension plans is the people using the current discount rate have not put in the amount of money that they should. Each year there's an annual required contribution, and going back in New Jersey to Christy Whitman, they decided not to do it.
You were saying they underfunded.
They underfunded.
Those.
They had a requirement that was using the old standards, and they didn't meet it. And Illinois is the worst offender in this regard. But there are other states that have done this. Nevertheless, overall, the states have done very well, even despite two recessions in the last 10 years. The home loan scandals of an earlier period, they've managed to keep their funding up. It was at 100% before the 2001 recession. They were 100% funded overall. So this is not a continuing problem. It's a problem of this recession and some particular states who need a targeted response.
Sarah.
Well, I'd have to disagree to say that this is just a problem that came along with the recession. It's a problem that's getting a lot of attention because it got a lot worse during the recession. But the bigger issue than trying to, you know, cut benefits that these public employees have earned is that states just manage their funds irresponsibly. And one way was underfunding, not putting enough aside. But the other thing was increasing employee benefits without paying for them. I mean, we saw temporary increases that ended up being permanent. And those are the kinds of things that now governors are looking at and saying, we actually have the ability to roll this back. And they're doing that.
Sarah Murray, she's economics reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Now, joining us by phone from an undisclosed location, Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor. She is one of 14 Democratic senators who fled the state rather than vote on a bill that would strip most state government workers of their collective bargaining rights. Good morning to you, Senator Taylor.
Good morning, Diane. It's such a pleasure to be on your show, and thank you for giving voice to the Wisconsin workers, to the Wisconsin 14 who are standing on the Constitution so that those Wisconsinites would be able to have a voice and have time to see this bill that's being rammed down their throat.
Tell me what you hope to accomplish and how long you figure you can stay out.
I think the answer to the first question is we wanted to accomplish slowing this bill down because although our governor says he doesn't like high-speed rail, he's taken this train and he's taken it rather fast and he's tried to run right over the Wisconsin workers and the Wisconsinites, more than a quarter of a million moving towards a half a million who have come to the Capitol to say that they completely disagree with him. So slowing down the bill was priority number one so that people would have an opportunity to know what was going on because they tried to ram this through in less than 5 days. It would have been 3 days if we had not left, and so that was a problem. We also wanted to make sure that people have an opportunity to find out what's in the bill because the bill has at least a third of it, and that's being kind, has no fiscal effect whatsoever. Like, for example, the no-bid contract that he has for the power plants and that his fourth largest contributor, the Koch brothers, seem to have an interest in. So this was really first and foremost about slowing it down, but also to give time to our Republican colleagues as well as to our governor to realize that the governor has won. He got everything he wants. He got all the concessions that he was requesting that they do. And because of that, we are saying, you won, governor. Now you don't have to take your citizens' rights away.
Now,
and that was the other reason. And how long? We're trying to give them time to do what they need to do so that they're not just denying citizens their First Amendment right, which is one of the things they did on the committee, but also hopefully that they won't be denying them rights that they presently have.
What do you think of Governor Walker's threats to begin laying off 1,500 public employees if you don't come back and vote?
You know, that's his choice. He doesn't have to do that. Those are not his only options. And we respect that he wants to be a bully and that he is not going to rise towards good leadership, which is consensus building, which is bringing people together to talk about how can we address the challenges that exist in our state. All he has to do is go to the bargaining table, accept the fact that he has won and all of his concessions have been done. Municipalities say that they don't want what he's doing. The unions have said they agree to his concessions, and almost 70% of Wisconsinites say that they believe that workers should have the right.
Tell me what concessions you're willing to make.
I believe that we have continued to express that the only thing that's important is to take out taking away the rights of workers. This was a legacy that was set in Wisconsin more than 50 to 100 years ago.
You're talking about collective bargaining rights.
Talking about being able to sit at the table to talk about your work conditions and to talk about all of the things that can affect workers, including worker safety. And those conditions are important issues that have to be discussed. So, yes, being able to sit at the table and bargain, the freedom to bargain, is what we're looking to see the governor not take away.
And if he doesn't?
Well, I'm hoping that, and I'm stepping on faith, that he is going to rethink his position and that he's going to take something from the playbook of his mentor that he always speaks about, which is the governor, from Indiana.
All right. Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor will be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org, by the David Geffen Foundation, supporting the vital role of quality journalism in this nation's civic life, and by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.
Oscar Wilde's novel on art and beauty with references to homosexuality shocked Victorian England. Censored when published in the 1890s, it still sparks debate today. A reader's review of The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde, The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. As we talk about the pension system for public employees, I'm going to open the phones now. Now we have two guests on the line, Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor, one of 14 Democrats who left the state rather than vote on a bill to strip most state government workers of their collective bargaining rights. We have Andrew Biggs. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Sarah Murray, economics reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and Ross Eisenbray of the Economic Policy Institute. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Roanoke, Virginia. Good morning, Rob. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. First, I have to say, my wife says every time she listens to your show, and it's true with myself also, and a question comes up in our mind, someone who's talking and seems to be avoiding the question, you always ask the question that we want to ask.
Thank you.
Thank you. My wife worked for the federal government for 30 years, and her position, and I'd be interested in the Wisconsin representative's comments on that collective bargaining is, I think there's no question it should be allowed. I think it's imperative. If it were transparent, it would also bring the public into knowledge, which is sort of what's been happening now that the representatives are out of the state. But do the public unions in Wisconsin have the right to strike? My wife feels that public employees providing a service can collectively bargain, but they should not strike.
Senator Taylor.
They cannot, which is one of the reasons why we were suggesting to our teachers that we did not want individuals staying away from our children so that our children would be able to get the education they need.
And Andrew Biggs, do you want to comment?
Well, I think we've been talking mostly about the pension issues, and I just think it's important to draw a distinction between what is going on this sort of these pension accounting issues and what you believe about the health of the pension and what is going on in Wisconsin or in other states. They really are distinct issues. The sort of the market valuation view for public pensions is not a partisan issue at all. So I just think they both play into each other, obviously, but I think we don't want to politicize one part by drawing it into another debate, which obviously is more political.
Sarah, do you agree with that?
I would have to disagree. I think these issues do go hand in hand, and they are both, you know, they both have a political underpinning. Whether you agree that on an 8% return investment, a 4% return, state and local officials see this pension transparency bill as sort of a veiled attack on, you know, public employees and public employee unions. And Wisconsin is sort of taking that, you know, a few steps further, but it's kind of in the same vein.
All right. To Haslett, Michigan. Jeff, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I appreciate the opportunity.
Sure.
2 points. One was I'd like to relay a common sense compromise that I think could be done, and then the second, there's a 800-pound gorilla that I'll discuss at the end, and then I'll take my answer off the air.
All right.
First of all, I work for a city very much like Madison, and their pension system has and does work very good. I am now medically retired, but they took 5% of our check out for 20 years, and there's an annuity that will pay my pension for 11 and a half years, and that's money taken out of my paycheck. And it just so happens the actuarial study shows the average worker in that city only lives 11 and a half years after his pension is drawn, and the national average is 22 years. So there's another point about what public workers face. So they are very well managed. We had 7% a year and as a base, and then it was so well managed that we often got a bonus with it. So it was agreed to by the union and the employer, and I think that there are common sense compromises that can be reached if you look around at successful programs, and the city
right.
that I worked for was one. And secondly, I just would like to mention a problem that nobody seems to want to talk about, and Governor Walker's even exempted them, and that is the police and fire pensions are not the same as the garbage collector or the forestry worker or the parks worker. They generally have 5 years less that they can retire in, like 20 years. They had a higher multiplier in their pension calculation where I worked. And they also had unlimited overtime, and that goes into their final average compensation, which greatly affects their pension.
That's interesting. Senator Taylor, why?
That is so...
Go ahead.
I wanted to comment on that, Diane, if I could.
Sure.
That's so very true. And I brought that issue up during finance because in my particular community in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, the amount that we pay for fire and police is the majority of the municipal budgets. And so even the municipalities are suggesting that this piece that the governor is doing, we're taking out bargaining, is not something that they agree with. And one of the reasons is because of the very thing that your caller just said. One of your other callers spoke about, you know, basically whether or not the pension issue is, you know, really separated. And I want to answer that, and it's really yes and no in some ways. In the situation that we're in now, the unions have already gave concessions related to pension and concessions related to health care. Do I agree that pension and health care issues, benefit issues, have been a huge driver in costs and challenges that exist, or even when we sit down at the bargaining table, some of the items that that are able to be bargained on. I'm not going to disagree with the governor that those things have created financial challenges. But what I'm not going to do is give him a pass. He has to sit down at the table. He should try. When I grew up and when I was growing up, my mother would always say, nothing beats a failure but a try. And what I find disgusting and what I find to be a lack of good leadership is someone who cannot see when nearly and growing to 250,000 of your residents are displeased with your choice. Individuals who voted for him, individuals who endorsed him and are saying now that they're sorry that they endorsed him and they regret their endorsement, it should at least make you pause and check yourself and to look at what you're doing. And what I don't like is that his leadership style says it's his way or the highway. It's a government of one. It's not a dictatorship. And he needs to accept the fact that he must engage with his people and with the legislature.
Andrew Biggs.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I agree that you want engagement on this, and certainly, you know, I'm not expert enough on Wisconsin politics to say one way or the other, you know, how things should go. I think, you know, there is a perception among people that the overall compensation for state and local employees may be above what some other folks get. I've done some work in that area. It's a complicated thing, and I don't think we can say one way or the other which way it goes. But we do know that the costs of pensions, retiree health care are a challenge, and you know, the sooner we come together and find a way to address it, I think the better off we'll be.
You know, it's interesting. We've had 4 or 5 emails from New Jersey listeners pointing to the fact that past New Jersey governors have borrowed from the pension plans to balance their budgets and then not paying them back. Why is this allowed and why is this not mentioned, Sarah?
I mean, it is allowed. It depends on the state. And this is what we're talking about when we say states have managed their pensions irresponsibly. Borrowing from your pension fund or not making the required contribution.
Well, that's very different then from the amount of interest or discounted rate that pensions earn. I think there is a connection, Sarah.
Diane, this is Andrew. There actually is a very direct connection. I mean, you know, Ross was certainly right that you know, a lot of states have not met their pension obligations. They've not paid as much in as they should have. Sarah's right in terms of the borrowing, we call pension obligation bonds, but the discounting, the accounting rules encourage all of this. If you're allowed to discount your liabilities at the return on the expected return of your assets, that encourages pensions to invest in riskier assets, which they have. They're now mostly in stocks, hedge funds. You know, for what Ross says about Wall Street, public pensions are the biggest holder of hedge funds in the country. That produces swings of value. So when in the good times they look overvalued, plans will raise. Well, they'll raise benefits, they'll stop making their contributions, and in the bad times, things look bad. If you use more conservative assumptions, more realistic assumptions, then this sort of dynamic just wouldn't happen. It's the same with the pension obligation bonds. Finally, I would just correct something, Sarah.
I don't disagree. I don't disagree with that, but I want to be really clear. In Wisconsin, the pension concessions and the health care concessions have all been provided. And if the governor was to sit at the table to say we need to draw new parameters or we need to think of new options where we can be more efficient in our services, but we can also figure out how to make sure that the risk that that we invest in, let's say in the pensions, that the swing is not such that it creates the same changes. Or get into the state system, for example, in our state, so that our health care costs can be different. The point is that you can't have those discussions if you don't sit at the table. Or if you're saying we don't want you to be able to negotiate certain items, or that we need to be able to do it in a quicker time period, whatever the issues are, my point is that you at least have to be at the table.
Right.
And so there's no question whether it is municipalities or whether it's, like, for example, our sewage district or our school districts all have issues. Our county all have issues with pension and even retirees and their pension and what that costs.
All right. But I want to read to you an email from Jackie, who says, talk to the retired employees of the city of Pritchard, Alabama. They contributed to their pension plan over 30 years of employment and are now getting zero. The underfunded pension plan ran out of money last year. Can you comment, Ross?
Well, we don't know what the circumstances are in Pritchard. We don't know whether there was embezzlement or whether they didn't make the required contributions. I think we really can't say in that particular case. And in fact, it's important not to paint with a broad brush here and say the states have done these things. Some states have done these things. Many states have well-managed pension plans. They didn't invest in risky assets, except when they were told that by Moody's and Wall Street that they were AAA-rated, completely safe investments. So, the problem is not pension plans per se.
Ross Eisenbray, the Economic Policy Institute, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning, Diane. This is a very important subject. I'm glad you're talking about it.
Thank you.
First, I want to say thank you to Senator Taylor for being on today and for doing what you're doing. You're doing the right thing. This is a terribly important conversation that we have across the country. And the longer that you and the other Democrats are out, the longer we'll be able to have this conversation and the more people understand what's really going on. What I think is really going on, and it is valuable to have these sort of economic policy discussions, I think what's really going on is this is a question of priority. This isn't about states not having enough money. This is about what do we do with the money we have. When Governor Walker came into office in Wisconsin, he came in with a budget surplus, and he went and pushed through tax cuts that the state of Wisconsin couldn't afford, giving away money to the wealthiest sectors of the economy there. And now he's turning around and saying the public sector unions have caused this crisis. It's just not true. I work for a public sector union here in Missouri, and we're seeing similar sort of things. They're not going after a right to bargain like they are in Wisconsin.
All right. I'm afraid you're breaking up on us, Adam. But Senator Taylor, talk about Adam's point that when the governor came in, there were something like $140 million in tax cuts that he gave. Go ahead.
$142 million, Diane, to be exact. And the part that I find rather frustrating is he did it under the guise, the same way that he lied to the people and said that he had to do a budget repair bill when we didn't meet the statutory trigger in our state for a budget repair bill. When he lied and said it was a budget repair bill, but a third of it has policy and favors for special interests who are his top four donors, his fourth highest donors. The same way he lied about the budget repair bill, he lied about what he called the job special session jobs. Or job special session for jobs, whatever it was zero jobs done in the entire session. There were eight bills that were done. Those bills cost $142 million. They were favors for the rich and not a job, period. And so this governor lies to the people, and he went and immediately came in spending the credit card and spending $142 million in our state. And this is, you know, it's unacceptable.
Sarah.
And the only way, one last thing, Diana,
sure.
The only way that we've been able to even bring light to what he was doing, because he introduced it late on a Friday. We were in finance on Tuesday, and then we're ready to put it on the floor on Thursday.
Sarah.
So.
Yeah. I mean, I think the problem here is that if you want to get concessions from public employee unions, you know, if you're saying you're having a hard time funding things, paying for this, that's fine, but you need to come to the table and be asking for shared sacrifice. So I think the problem in Wisconsin is the perception is there's not a shared sacrifice. The perception is the governor is doing what he wants. He's putting his priorities on the table and then saying, all right, we're going to take from you to fund those priorities. And that doesn't foster good political will among anyone.
Andrew Biggs.
Well, no, I agree with Sarah that there should be shared sacrifice. I think, though, some of the sort of the hostility you're getting towards
public employees is, you know, comes because the economy is bad. People have seen their jobs lost. I mean, public employees have a 1/3 chance of being, you know, fired or laid off as private sector employees. So, you know, there is this feeling in the economy. I mean, if these were good economic times, I doubt we would be having, you know, these kinds of fights right now.
Ross, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, 250,000 public employees have lost their jobs in this recession. So they've taken it on the chin already.
Ross Eisenberry at the Economic Policy Institute, Sarah Murray of the Wall Street Journal, Andrew Biggs of the American Enterprise Institute, and Wisconsin State Senator Lena Taylor. Thank you all so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.